Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Hey, it's Ryan. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I love newsletters, of course. Daily Stoic is a newsletter. If you didn't know that, you should definitely subscribe. Daily Dad is a daily newsletter we do. There's a bunch of newsletters I like. I've gotten Maria Popova's Brain Pickings newsletter for many, many years. She just renamed it the Marginalia. I like Emily Oster's parenting newsletter. That's a great one that I get. I love Tim Ferriss's Five Bullet Friday. That's a great one that I get. One of my researchers, Billy Oppenheimer, has a great newsletter that I love that you can sign up for at billyoppenheimer.com. I like Matt Levine's newsletter for Bloomberg Money Stuff. I like The Dispatch, David French especially. I love Andrew Sullivan. I love Heather Cox Richardson's newsletter, Letters from an American. I just love newsletters. They're great. It's a great way to get information. They're not filled with ads. It's not a bunch of stuff to click. You read it in the browser. You read it on your phone. You print them out. Just a newsletter I love. It's been a great way for me to learn over the years. And of course, been transformative for me. My reading list newsletter, which I started like a decade ago, is now a bookstore. The Painted Porch Bookstore here in Bastrop, Texas would not exist if I hadn't started that newsletter where I just recommended my favorite books that I read each month, which I'd love to have you sign up for if you haven't. And again, Daily Stoic being the newsletter that fundamentally changed my life and is now the largest collection of Stoics anywhere in the world. So one of the fastest growing newsletters in recent history has been Morning Brew, sort of a media business newsletter supposed to give millennials, young people, like a rundown of everything that's happening in the world. And my guest today, Alex Lieberman, is the co-founder and executive chairman of Morning Brew. He just sold a majority stake of it to Business Insider this year for a reported $75 million. It's a huge newsletter. He was an Ad Age 40 under 40, Forbes 30 under 30 recipient. He has a podcast for Fidelity Investments. He's talked all over the world. You can follow him on Twitter at Business Barista. And of course, sign up for Morning Brew at morningbrew.com. It also happens that Alex is a student, recent student of Stoicism. I saw him tweeting about it and we connected. And we were going to, you meet people and they go, hey, you want to have a phone call? We should connect. And instead of doing a 20-minute perfunctory phone call, I thought, why don't we just record an episode of the podcast and we'll just talk about Stoicism. We'll talk about life. We'll talk about newsletters. And that's what we've got here in this conversation with Alex Lieberman. I think you'll like it. And I was glad to get to know Alex through it and enjoy this combo. Let's start with your introduction to Stoicism, because I'm always curious about how people heard about it and maybe what struck them about it.
Yeah. So, you know, I've known about Stoicism for a fair bit of time. I want to say, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And I think I actually first came across it when Tim Ferriss had referenced, a Seneca quote or some quote on Twitter. And I had this perception, right? We all create stories. I had created the story of what Stoicism was without even knowing what it was. And
What was that story?
Yeah, the story that I created was Stoicism sounds like it's a derivation of being Stoic. And that is the exact opposite of what I'm trying to achieve because, you know, for context, I grew up like in a Wall Street family, not super, pretty unemotional. And for the longest time, I've actually wanted to do more to tap into my emotions and be an emotive person. And so I just created this very simple story in my head of like, I'm trying to be less Stoic, not more Stoic. Stoicism is based off of being Stoic. Therefore, I'm not interested in Stoicism. And so that was my story for the longest time. And then what happened was I did this speaking engagement, I don't know, 6 months ago. And the guy who arranged it, as a thank you for me speaking, he sent me a book. And honestly, it was so nice. Like I really am not sent books when I'm sent thank you things. And it was like actually the coolest thing to just get a book in the mail thanking me for my time. And what he basically said is, I read this as I was trying to gain more clarity in my professional journey. And I really loved it. And I think you'll love it too. And so what the book was is it's this beginner's guide to Stoicism. Tools for emotional resilience and positivity. And
what's it called?
It's called The Beginner's Guide to Stoicism, Tools for Emotional Resilience and Positivity by Matthew Van Natta.
Okay.
And it's like a little handbook size thing, and it has like 150 pages. And so
I know this book. Yeah. He sent me this before. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. 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 And so this was kind of like the reminder to me, the thing that re-upped it. And I think the reason I actually started reading this was I was feeling particularly lost. I had been doing a lot of soul searching on kind of like how I want to spend my time. And this book was on my bookshelf and I picked it up one day and I read the description again, which was Tools for Emotional Resilience and Positivity. And I think I looked at that word positivity and I was like, this breaks my story. This isn't part of my story of what being Stoic is. So maybe there's a difference between Stoicism and being Stoic. And so I broke open the book. I went to the dog park with my dog Rambo for two or three hours and I just read the whole thing.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I think that's actually an interesting marketing thing you brought up, which is like, so sometimes people will question like certain decisions that I make in how I present work or videos I'll do or whatever. But yep. Like the idea that every customer or every person has a story and that this story is often limiting in some way. And that when you present something or you put something out in the world, you're not just having to represent it as it is, but you're also having to anticipate potential objections that people might have and present yourself in a way that you either don't threaten or you don't meet those reservations. Like for instance, my book, The Obstacle is the Way, deliberately says nothing about Stoicism on the cover because I found that Stoicism, people have the exact impression that you said. And so if you put Stoicism, let's say in the title, although I obviously did this later with the Daily Stoic, but up front, you are often limiting yourself. And so that's a very interesting story.
Well, and what I like about even, you know, I have Daily Stoic in front of me right now also, and it's like, at least for me, and I would assume there are a fair number of people like me, because what I ended up doing is after reading this book, I have a podcast of my own, and I did one episode on basically my learnings about Stoicism from reading this book. And I had so many of my listeners who basically wrote back saying the same thing, that they were like, oh, this is so interesting. I've heard of this, but I assumed it had to deal with being emotionless. So I never thought to dive deeper. And so, I mean, even in Daily Stoic, right? Like on the cover, you have the 366 meditations on wisdom, perseverance, and the art of living. To me, that provides more flavor that potentially counteracts the narrative that I and many people have. But yeah, I think it's in a lot of ways just like a branding question more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think I say that in the intro of the Daily Stoic, that the phrase Stoic philosophy is like perhaps two of the least appealing words in the English language combined to make a super unappealing phrase. And so if you want to reach people, which obviously you want to do with a book, but you definitely want to do if you have something you believe in that you want people to, you want to reach people with, you have to find a way, if not to subvert it, then to anticipate and address. And you just don't want to be running into a headwind. You want to try to find a way always. Just like I'm sure with the morning brew, if you're like, there's something sort of light and nice about the name that's not like, even though it's a serious email, it's not like, this is something you're going to dread doing in the morning.
Oh, totally. And by the way, that's like why we spend so much time in the early days, especially, but even today on subject lines, right? Because like, it's like the goal with writing as well, right? It's like when you write a sentence, your goal is to get someone to read the next sentence. And it's like, you know, if your goal is to get someone to learn and benefit from the principles of Stoicism, it's to get someone to be willing to actually learn what those are. And like for Morning Brew, the number one thing that determined if people were going to read our whole newsletter is if the subject line was enticing enough to get them to open. And we would test our subject line. We still do it. Where at 5 in the morning Eastern time, we send 4 batches of emails to a group of 10,000 people, and it's 4 different subject lines. We let those go out for an hour, and then at the end of the hour, it's 6 a.m., we see what the difference in all those subject lines is in terms of open rate, and then we send the remaining, call it 3.4 million email addresses, the winning open rate, because that literally was the difference of, call it 50 to 100,000 more people reading it a day.
Right. So what do you think hit you about Stoicism, other than this idea that you were very, very repressed and now Stoicism is going to open you up? What do you think hit you about the philosophy that and maybe why it didn't hit you earlier?
So here's my honest take on it, which is, you know, after we sold Morning Brew in late 2020, call it 4 months later, was when I moved out of the CEO role into the executive chairman role, which is the role I'm in now. So I'm not in the day-to-day of the business, and I'm spending more time creating content, working with my co-founder on like high-level strategy. And I felt, I honestly felt directionless, and I felt like I was in this circular reference of a story that I had created. And I was basically trying to figure out, how do I get out of this circular reference? And kind of like what the story was, okay, we sold the company. I thought money was going to make a big difference to my happiness in life. It has not. It is not going to be a crutch anymore for doing things to get money, because money will give me happiness. You know, I've been given the freedom of time now, and I don't feel any better. This sucks. that was kind of like my circular reference. And at the same time as doing that, I had all these doubts that about like, what does the future hold for me? Like, I don't want to be the 28-year-old who peaked at 28. I don't want to be the one-trick pony. I don't know if I could build another business again. Did I get lucky? Like this was the narrative I was telling myself, right? And it's so different from, I would say, people on the outside. They'd be like, oh, wow, you know, those guys from Morning Brew built this amazing media business. They bootstrapped it for 5 years. Like they're incredibly talented. And that was totally not the story that I had. And so that's why I think I went on this exploration to Stoicism, because I was like, this sucks. And what I'm realizing is basically we all have, from my perspective, two realities. We have the reality of what actually happens in the world, like objectively what occurs. And then we have our story and our perception of what occurs. And I want to figure out how I can gain clarity around my story and my perception and get myself out of this circular reference. And so, you know, reading about Stoicism, I think to me, actually was, you know, I'd spent time studying mindfulness as well. And to me, Stoicism, I almost thought was a great bridge of some of the things that I've learned in, call it, 8 years of doing therapy. So like traditional sure. Western psychological practice that I would say is very much about like labeling, naming, and prescribing. And then mindfulness, which I would say can be very high level, ambiguous, up for interpretation. And for me, at least my what I really loved about both your book and this original book I read was it brought specificity to some of these higher level concepts, right? So like the idea of basically like how focusing on controlling the things you can control and not focusing on not controlling the things you can't control, right? It's like, it's so obvious. And I think there's so much in both Eastern and Western that talks about this, but I just found it to be very approachable when reading Stoicism in a way that made sense to me and it was practical.
What did you, so I assume that the business was making a good chunk of money.
But yep.
What did you think that suddenly tens of millions of dollars was going to change for you?
I think part of it was that I had money anxiety in general growing up, in the sense of like I was afraid to spend money, you know, especially after when I was a junior in college, my dad passed away, and I kind of like had made this promise to myself that I would be the person to bring in money for my family. And I had anxiety around like the fact that everyone in the Lieberman household was cash outflow and there was no cash inflow. And so I think in my head, the story I told myself was that when I have some large windfall of money, that money anxiety will go away because I'll feel like I am able to provide for my family and provide for myself in a way that I will not have any sort of money insecurity or anxiety moving forward.
So you suddenly actually get like more money than a person could possibly need. What does that feel like? What actually does change? I'm always fascinated. I've not gotten a good self-aware answer from a single person, from just sort of regular successful entrepreneurs up to like legit billionaires. But I am curious, like, so suddenly, you know, there's 9 or 10 figures in one's bank account. What changes?
Yeah. Well, what I would say is not a whole lot. and I think that's also that really is a function of values, right? In the sense that like I don't place a lot of value on buying very expensive things, right? Like I was actually talking to my executive coach today and he was like, what do you want when you grow up? And I was just like, I want to have a family with 3 kids. I want to have 2 homes, one in like the tri-state area, one in Colorado would be awesome. I'd love to take great vacations with my family. I'd love to have new experiences with my family and friends. And in doing all that, I don't want to have any anxiety about money. That's kind of like, that's my image. And I think part of the reason nothing changed is, you know, I'm still 28. I still don't have a family yet. None of these massive purchases or things have come up yet. But in the same sort of way, and I think it's what's making me realize a lot of this like money insecurity and anxiety is irrational. I think I still have as much insecurity or anxiety about money today as I did before the transaction.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Wow.
Which is such a fascinating thing.
Have you listened to Ramit Sethi's podcast?
So I've read some of Ramit's stuff. I haven't listened to the podcast.
Podcast is great. I know I'm using my podcast to rave about his, but I was just listening to an episode the other day where it was a couple, they work at tech companies. They've been successful. They have a net worth of $8 million and they comparison shop for blueberries, right? Like they're sort of stuck in this cycle. I think we all get scripts or ideas about money or what it means or what it will do for us. And then whether you have $80,000 or $8 million, you're still trapped in that thing. I think you would really like it, but I'm a big fan of that podcast.
Yeah, yeah. I'll listen to it. And I think what you said is like, I do think in general, we get trapped in stories as well, right? Like this story in my mind was that, money equals success. The more that I have of it, the more successful that I am. Also, the more that I have of it, the less that I have any anxiety around it. And I think it's one of those things where even like rationally, where you know you see those statistics about once someone is making a certain level of income, I can't remember. It depends where you are in the U.S.
It's like 70 grand.
Exactly.
Something.
Yeah. Like. Yeah, like 70 grand, your marginal happiness per dollar you make goes down significantly. Like you hear that and you rationalize it. But at least for me, it was very hard for me to appreciate that until I lived it. And now that I've lived it, I'm just like, no dollar is going to change my marginal happiness. And so I really need to look inward to gain a sense of clarity and happiness just through my perception of the world.
Well, this is really interesting too, because, and I think this is why the Stoics resonate with me more than some of the Eastern philosophers, is that although there were certainly impoverished Stoics, Epictetus being one, you know, Marcus Aurelius is very wealthy, Seneca is very wealthy, Cato is very wealthy, Zeno comes from wealth, loses it, and then seems to get a chunk of it back. The idea being that they were like real human beings in the real world who were probably all primed, like we all are, to think that more is better and that you will be happy when you have more. But then, unlike a lot of philosophers, they actually got more, right? So it's like very easy to go like, more will be better, or to say more doesn't mean anything. But like, it matters if you actually have tested the hypothesis in the real world, not just in the classroom. And you get Seneca basically saying like, look, it's better to be rich than poor. in the sense that it's probably better to be tall than short, beautiful than ugly, or to have two arms versus one arm.
Yep.
If you had your preference, that's what you would do. But you are also at a place where you don't need it either way. So like when the Stoics talk about indifference, we tend to think indifference means you don't like it, which is obviously the definition of what indifference does not mean. For the Stoics, indifference was like good one way or the other.
Totally. Yeah. I think it totally makes sense. And you know, as I was reading both books and I think about this generally as like I'm kind of practicing call it like my inner work, is so much of what I'm trying to do is just like unlearn the expectations, anxieties, and like regrets that the world has taught to me, and not necessarily intentionally, but like in so many ways when I feel like I'm you know, practicing whatever it may be, like controlling things I can control, or living in the present, or separating like my reactions to kind of my final judgments, like I don't know, in a lot of ways I feel like I'm just trying to live like a child again.
What does that mean?
Like, in so many ways, when I think about when Alex Lieberman was in kindergarten, I would say like Alex Lieberman was his happiest self. Like I loved learning in my kindergarten classroom with Miss Golo. I was super creative. I remember in kindergarten, like I felt like I was the smartest person on planet Earth because I took a pen and a highlighter. I cut them each in half. I taped them together. And I was like, I'm a freaking genius. I just made a pen highlighter 2-in-1. And like, I'd go on the playground. I'd play with kids. I'd laugh a ton. I wouldn't be thinking about like, oh, yesterday, when Sally said something mean to me in kindergarten class, I still really am dwelling on that. Or I wouldn't say to myself, oh shit, like, am I going to do well in kindergarten in terms of my final grade at the end of this year? Like, those were never thoughts, right? And so obviously it's not realistic because we live in a society where expectations, progress, like it is both measured and it's how society's structured. But like, there's so many things I admire about the way I was able to live when I was in kindergarten.
Well, yeah, I think there's a certain presentness to children, an openness to children, an acceptance to children, even though they throw tantrums about things. They're just sort of like, they're sort of, I think, aware of how little control they have. So there's like, oh, this is where we're going. Okay, you know? And there is a, I think what comes from that are some things you don't necessarily think about as Stoic, but like sort of joy.
Yeah.
You know, it is a more, you know, the Stoics talk about living in accordance with nature. And I think children are more in that state, the connection to the sort of world. Whereas like we live in this place where we think we're in control, we have things we're trying to do. We have what the Buddhists call willful will. And I think that is at the root of a lot of our unhappiness.
Yeah, no, 100%. And it's even like, I don't know, I was just thinking about how one of the things that really stuck with me in terms of like desiring and focusing on the things that are within our complete control, right? It's such a obvious point when you say it out loud, like, oh yeah, obviously I'm only going to focus on the things I can control. But then when you actually reflect on the things that drove your emotions in the last 24 hours, how many of those things were based on what you could control?
Yeah, most of what you spend your time on is stuff that's not in your control. Like it's just like, oh yeah, let's focus on what we control. That's really obvious. And then it's like, okay, but what did I spend the majority of my time, energy, and emotional energy on in the last 24 hours? It was the opposite of things that are in my control.
Yeah. And I would say for me, like the vast majority of it is like anticipatory anxiety, where it's like when I would be managing people within Morning Brew and I would need to say hypothetically tell them that they're not doing what's expected of them in work, especially in the early days when I was a first time manager, I would default to not saying the thing because I'd be so concerned about how they would react. But like, that's kind of like not my thing to own. My thing to own is, how can I deliver this in a way that is clear and empathetic and compassionate? But I can't worry about how someone is going to respond to that if it's going to impact my ability to do what I think is most important and is within my control. And like, I feel like that is the story of 90% of managers.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, I think the idea to me where Stoicism really fits well in the idea of management, and you know, the Stoics were managers, with, back to Marcus Aurelius, he's the manager of the largest empire in the world, is like, you wake up and shit goes wrong. That is like, that is the entrepreneur's life, is it's never going the way you want it to go. And you're forced to improvise, adapt, accept, you know, change around what's happening in the world and what's happening with your people. Because that's, I think, the tricky part about running a company is that it is dependent on a bunch of people who you do not control. Even though you're their boss, you do not control them. You don't control what they think. You don't control what they, how quickly they do. It's this thing that you're only nominally the head of, and you have to figure out how to make it work, however imperfect it is.
I'm not sure if you know the answer to this, but like something I've thought about, you know, how kind of the Stoics would think about this is, like you just mentioned, like shit hits the fan and work all the time. And I think actually my thing that happened that was very adaptive and it served me well, but I think there's trade-off to it, is I learned how to become kind of like numb to shit hitting the fan and work, meaning something would go horribly wrong and I'd always be like, oh, it's fine. We're going to figure it out. Like that would be kind of my default, is I would literally not experience the experience because I needed to stay level-headed and fully objective. But I think there's a trade-off to not fully feeling your emotions or experiencing that emotion in a way that is productive. Do the Stoics say anything about like how to, feel or experience your emotion, but do so in a productive way where it doesn't hold you back?
Well, I think so, two things. So one, yeah, that is obviously the job of the leader, because if shit hits the fan and then the leader freaks out, like, where does that leave everyone else, right? Totally. Like it's sort of like if the parents are handling it badly, then the kid either is in real bad shape or the kid has to then go do the adult job, which isn't fair, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there is a higher standard for the leader. And Seneca talks about this in his essay on anger. He's like, look, normal people in smaller positions can be angry, have feuds, get worked up about stuff, etc. But you, the emperor, he's writing mostly to Nero, it seems like, you can't, it's too expensive for you, right? Like too much is dependent on. So you have to sort of be more controlled than the average person. But Seneca also talks about sort of generally with emotions, this idea that like there is the immediate reaction, fantasia, that you feel, like if somebody jumps around a corner and scares you, you can feel that. It's just, what do you do in reaction to it after? So
right.
To go to the idea of anger, like if someone says something hurtful or some employee really screws something up, like you could be upset. This thing just cost you, you know, $1 million, but the decision to call them into your office and chew them out about it or abuse them about it, that is where the line is, right? So it's like, you can have the emotion, you just have to understand that as the leader, you are circumscribed in your ability to act on that emotion. And that this is probably a good thing, right? Like the idea is to process that emotion, figure it out, instead of just dumping it on someone, which totally. I'm very guilty of myself. So I'm not trying to say this from some place of sageness.
Totally. And I think, again, the way you put it makes total sense, right? Like you can have both, but you just can't have one impact the other in a way that holds back your ability to run a business or any relationship with clarity of thought. I will say, at least from my own experience, I found it very difficult at times to create that delineation where it gets blurred. And sure. I think out of fear that I will act emotionally, I end up acting, I would say, more like a robot than someone who's overly emotional.
Well, this is something that I've benefited from in mindfulness and in meditation. The idea of like you're having, like, so you're sitting there and you're trying to have no thoughts, right? And so the mind's like, here's a thought, here's a thought, here's a thought, right? This is sort of witnessing that this is what your mind does. Yeah. And then what they teach in mindfulness is the idea of going like, yes, you're having the thought, but you don't have to accept the thought, right? Like the idea of seeing thoughts as sort of clouds in the sky, they're there, you acknowledge them, but you don't try to grab hold of them. You just sort of totally. Let them come in and out of the frame. And like, this is something I've been dealing with just like how screwed up the world is right now. It's like this, you know, it looks like the Supreme Court's going to do this, and it looks like they're going to do this, and it looks like this is the latest on this variant, or, you know, here's some awful trend that's sort of looming in the background that you're powerless to do anything about. I'm trying to remind myself, like, you can have that feeling. Like, that is scary. It's weird. It's disappointing. It's not what I would choose if I had a choice. And then I can just sort of sigh and then get back to what I should be doing, right? Like, totally, you don't have to be anguished about it. You don't have to be consumed by it. You don't have to pretend it's not there, but you also don't have to give yourself over to it.
Totally. Well, I mean, like, even it's kind of the same exact thought on, call it, like, the Western side with a lot of the work I do with my therapist. It's around, you know, I suffer from OCD. It's manifested in many, in different ways over, call it, like, the last decade of my life. And there are different ways that you can work through or work with OCD. One way is exposure therapy. The other way is ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. And it's basically, in my mind, acceptance and commitment therapy is kind of a prescribed or labeled version of meditating or practicing mindfulness, in the sense that you acknowledge that a feeling is there, but you don't extrapolate it to your entire experience. You know, the way that my therapist has always kind of like explained it, similar to like the cloud analogy or like the meditation analogy of like a moving river with things moving through the river, is, it's like if you have like one of those little swimmers in your eye, and the swimmer is like in the top left corner, it is there. It is annoying. It is inhibiting your vision a little bit, but it is not blinding you. It is not blocking your entire vantage point. It's just there, and it's annoying, and that's okay.
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like, for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. It's obviously easy to sort of agree in theory. And then, of course, when it's more than just a swimmer in your eye and it feels really scary or weird or upsetting, then it's sort of like, you know, getting yourself under control when you relapse.
Totally. And by the way, like, I think without getting too much into kind of like the deep discussion about it, like, I think we've kind of just seen that on like the world stage with all the conversation around the virus and the vaccines is like kind of all these different viewpoints on what is the right procedure to stay healthy and safe, where there's so much information, there's information overload, but there are also a lot of questions that aren't exactly answered yet, right? Even with the new variant, it hasn't exactly been answered yet. You know, how virulent is it? How easily spreadable is it? And I think when there's ambiguity, when people's health is at risk, things get very emotional. And I think it creates a great opportunity for like the separation of emotional and like logical discussion. It creates a great opportunity for that to happen. But kind of to your point, when this is like a very real concern that hundreds of millions of people are experiencing, sometimes it's way easier said than done.
Yeah. And I don't know when people will be listening to it, but it's a great example, right? So as you and I are talking, we're like 3 days into the acknowledgement or the recognition of the new variant, which has a stupid name. It's a great illustration of the failures of communication of the various agencies in the world that they would pick a long ass variant name that is not clear how to pronounce. Like, why wouldn't they just call it Omi, right? Or Omni, or any, like, who cares about whether it normally is connected to this alphabet or that?
Couldn't but be easy.
Yes, I digress. What I think is interesting is they're like, look, this is it. We know that it exists. We don't know. We know that obviously it'd be better if it didn't exist, but we don't actually know the implications of it. And we won't know for approximately 2 weeks. So everyone's going to have to sit in a period of unknowing, right? Which is about the hardest thing you can possibly ask of people. And you've watched, even in the last 3 or 4 days, people trying to, it's not that they want a shortcut, but they're just like, I know you said 2 weeks, but could this be the answer? Could this be evident? And so instead of just like I was saying, going like, hey, this is there, and you're going to have to live the next 2 weeks of your life with this sort of looming uncertainty, people are like, well, what if I doom scroll all day? Will that make the answer come sooner? Or, you know, what if I just freak out? Or what if I start blaming fingers? Or what if I go into denial about it? And it's like, none of those change the fact that you have to sit uncomfortably with this thing for 2 weeks. And by the time people are listening to this, it could be the worst case scenario. It could be the best case scenario having revealed itself. But nothing that happened in this period will have changed that or made one or the other more or less likely. And people just really struggle. Marcus Aurelius in Meditations talks about having no opinion. He says you always have the power of having no opinion, but that's a power we relinquish, you know, pretty much all the time.
So, yeah, 100%. It's again, it goes back to control. There's nothing we can do to control the situation. But yeah, ambiguity is, again, like, I have personally struggled with ambiguity for my whole life. And I'm just seeing people who I haven't seen struggle with it in the same way that I have for so long, struggle with it as a function of what's going on in the world right now. And it's, like you said, it is really difficult. We don't know what's going to happen, but also it's not within our control to dictate what's going to happen.
The other thing that connects stoicism to the pandemic the best, and it's a quote, again, easier said than done, but one of my favorite passages in Meditations, Marcus Aurelius goes, look, is a world without shameless people possible? And he goes, no, of course not. He says a certain percentage of the people are going to be shameless. So when you meet a shameless person, like, why are you surprised, first? But second, like, know that this is one of that percentage, right? If it's one out of 100, you met one. Okay, that's one out of 100. You knew they existed. And I think, and I've struggled with this myself, like, there was never a possibility where 100% of the people were going to take the pandemic seriously, where 100% of the people were going to get vaccinated, where 100% of the people were going to do any of these things. And yet, we are dismayed every time we meet one of those people. Now, obviously, there's a difference between 30% of the population and 10%. And there is a certain amount of that that's in the control, if not of us, then of like sort of policy and public culture and how one handles things. And you can influence that number. But the idea that you were ever going to get everyone on board was naive and impossible. And so I do take some solace in the like, look, certain percentage of the population is going to be selfish and stupid. Certain percentage of the population is going to be misinformed. Certain percentage of the population is going to be, you know, misled and used against their own interests, etc. So you've just got to accept that when you meet one of those people.
Totally. Yeah. I think it's so well said. And honestly, like what a lot of this just has me thinking about, and I've been thinking about this a lot recently as I think about kind of like my journey and also as just I've consumed your content, is just like, just think about how much, just how many more tools you have personally, given all of like the study you've done in Stoicism, just to navigate life and everything it has to offer. And I've done 1/1000th of your study, but I have found even tools already. And I don't know, I've just thought to myself recently, like how amazing of a world it would be when people have these new tools through inner work. And obviously it feels like things like meditation and mindfulness are so much more prevalent today than even say my parents' generation, but it still feels so incredibly early. And obviously as someone who's grown up in media for the last 6 years and just like the power of building a trusted audience and delivering a message that can have an impact, I've just thought to myself, there's like, I think there's such a white space for, I don't know, like whether it's making Stoicism go viral, making mindfulness, making inner work go viral, in the sense of like making it approachable to people where it becomes a daily practice at a mass scale. And obviously I'm assuming that was one of your goals with, you know, things like Daily Stoic.
Yeah, of course. Of course. The idea of like, how do you take these ideas that are simple, but perhaps inaccessible at the beginning, and bring them to people? Just like, yeah, there's really nothing in Morning Brew that people couldn't find elsewhere. But the point is, the value proposition is like, now you don't have to find it elsewhere. Like the point is in the aggregation, right? Or in the collection, or in the lens, or the angle. And, you know, sometimes people will say this, like they'll be like, oh, why are you reading Ryan's stuff? You should just read the originals. And it's like, literally nothing would make me happier, but that wasn't exactly happening at any, significant number until I started doing this, right? Or that was very unlikely, not to take credit for it then, but that was also very unlikely that this chunk of the population that I'm speaking to would have been doing that. Now they are. And so it's funny how people can get sort of really snooty about stuff when actually it is bringing about exactly the thing they claim to want to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think about content in three ways. I think about it as original creation, curation, and in that bucket, I put curation and remixing, and then translation. And I think we put so much emphasis in society on creation that like, oh, I need to be a creator. I need to put stuff out. It needs to be my own original thoughts. I need to be the first person that thought of this. Like the news flash is that like pretty much everything that all of us are thinking of is not an original thought. And that's okay. That's not a bad thing. There have been a lot of people on planet Earth that have had similar brains to ours. But I think so much of the value, especially in the fire hose that the internet has afforded us today, is in curation, remixing, and translation. And that's basically exactly what you've described, in the same way, like with Thinking Like a Monk by Jay Shetty. Like I think it did the same thing, because I tried reading some Buddhist texts and I couldn't get through it. And I think also the hard thing here, the harder thing, which I'm interested in how you think about, is like with Morning Brew, the reason we thought it would stick is because our view is like a 26-year-old professional wants to look good in front of their boss. And to do that, they need to know what's going on in the world, but they don't have a lot of time to do that. So like Morning Brew is like stupidity insurance, so you don't look bad in front of your boss. And so I like every product I think about how is it a painkiller or how is it a vitamin? And the issue is I think some of the most helpful products in the world are vitamins, but people gravitate towards painkillers, things that alleviate pain today.
Sure.
And so I, you know, in some ways, like I think about stoicism and mindfulness and even personal finance in this bucket of vitamins. And the question is how do you create urgency for people to engage in vitamins when the long-term benefit is one that compounds on itself and you don't necessarily see today?
Well, I went through this with the trilogy that I did on stoicism, Obstacles Away, Ego's the Enemy, and Stillness is the Key. It was realizing, especially with the first book, it was like, I wanted to write a book about Stoic philosophy, but I knew that the vast majority of people were not interested in Stoic philosophy. But most people have problems, right? Most obstacles are a universal fact of life. And so the idea is, oh, okay, let me present a part of Stoic philosophy as a tool for dealing with obstacles or a solution to your problem. So it's like very few people, and I remember saying this to the publisher, very few people wake up in the morning and say, I want to know about Stoic philosophy. They do say, I have a problem and I need a solution. And so if you can meet people where they are, you can present. So vitamin is effectively preventative, right? And I think that's people are bad at sort of prevention. But if you say, actually, this vitamin is a painkiller, right? Then you
it becomes alleviation.
Exactly. And so that it's like, I want to get you there when you're like, whether it's an athlete who just blew out their knee or it's somebody who just went through a divorce or, you know, blah, blah, blah. I want to get you there. And then you go, oh, this actually is a framework worth exploring more fully and can be applied outside the narrow context in which I was originally envisioning it.
Yeah, I think that makes total sense.
You seem like you spend a lot of time on Twitter. I was curious about this sort of fire hose. Obviously, I have a Twitter account and we use one for my account and Daily Stoic, but I just find that I never feel better after I've been on Twitter.
I've spent a lot of time thinking about this and like, because, so I would say I got introduced to Twitter, call it 2 years ago by...
That's it?
Yeah, by my co-founder. I knew what it was, but I didn't really spend time on Twitter. And I would say I sometimes feel really good on Twitter and I sometimes feel really shitty on Twitter. And the reason, I would say the reason I feel shitty is actually not the reason that a lot of people feel shitty. I feel like a lot of people feel shitty because they doom scroll on Twitter. They see sad things happening in the world. They see really polarizing conversations and they're like, what's the world come to? For me personally, that's not what makes me feel shitty. What makes me feel shitty is honestly that it is an addictive platform. Mm-hmm. It is addictive just like any other social media. I think one, I procrastinate too much as a function of Twitter. And then I feel shitty because I've effectively not kept my promise to myself of not going on Twitter and doing the thing that I said I was going to do. And then I feel really bad because if I can't keep my word to myself, who am I going to keep my word to? And I think the second reason I end up not feeling great on it at times is because I feel that gravitational pull to look at the likes I'm getting and the retweets. And that is the exact, call it like trigger for enjoyment that I don't want to be perpetuating, right? Like I was even thinking the other day, I would love to create kind of like a tool or a Chrome add-in where I could publish my tweets, but it never shows likes or retweets or comments going up. All I can look at is the content that I've put out and that's it. And I have to just have a love for the information that I've put out.
But you can do that. I mean, that's how I sort of do it, which is that I write all the things that I post, but then one, it goes to someone on my team. But even then, it just gets scheduled, right? So like I don't interact. It's a one-way medium, unfortunately. I wish it could be otherwise, but for me, it's a one-way medium.
And I think that is the healthier way. The only thing that I find that you could possibly miss out on as a function of making it one way is called like the amazing conversations and connections that happen in DMs on Twitter. So like just some amazing people that I've met. Like, I wouldn't have connected with you.
Especially if you have the check mark. You get it's like this weird, like, side door loophole to connect with people you could never, you would never be in the same room with. You'd never have their phone number.
Exactly.
It's weird.
And so a lot of people that I now actively text with every day, just talking about interesting topics, some related to work, some related to Web 3.0 and NFTs, some not related to work at all, and just like kind of the journey that I've just discussed, those happen through originally DMs on Twitter, and those happen on DMs on Twitter as a function of them seeing my content on Twitter.
I think that's how we got connected. You tweeted something about Stoicism, but then somebody sent it to me because they knew I wouldn't see it. And then I DM'd you and here we are.
Exactly. So we wouldn't have gotten connected otherwise. Or if we would, maybe we would have, it just would have happened at a different time. And so that's the hard thing for me is I think if I treated Twitter in the same way you treat it, there'd be so much benefit. I wouldn't feel really crappy about the validation and happiness I feel from likes and the dopamine hits. And I wouldn't feel like I'm not keeping my word to myself, but I would feel like I've deprived myself of a form of community building and connection. And maybe one could argue you could accomplish that elsewhere. But I just haven't figured out a great alternative yet.
No, I get it too. I find Instagram seems to be a platform that you get most of the benefits, less of the aftertaste, and you still get the same sort of DM benefit, I guess. But
I just got to build a bigger audience on Instagram then, I guess, because I'm not getting access to cool people to DM with.
I just find Twitter is sort of radicalized, like, otherwise thoughtful people. And so it's like Twitter is overtly political, whereas like Instagram and the other networks have a political component, but it hasn't, the tail isn't wagging the dog. And so, like, I remember in the early days of Twitter, I was actually in Austin in 2007 at South by Southwest when Twitter, launched. I remember I was with Tim Ferriss, and, Tim was like, I was like, this is the dumbest idea I've ever heard. And Tim invested in it. So I guess that shows the difference between us. But I remember like people used to talk about pizza on Twitter and there was jokes and it would like Twitter wasn't the sort of toxic cesspool that it's become. And I think there is a part of these networks where you sort of like you get something out of them and then the ratio twists and you got to be able to be like, yeah, I'm getting off this.
Totally. And by the way, the last thing that I didn't mention that I find to be particularly unhealthy about Twitter for me is, again, all of us in life do some level of social comparison. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly thinking about how can I build more internal sense of self so that kind of like that voice can be quieted a little bit. But I find that it is definitely activated in a very real way on Twitter. And I think that's a function of the crowd that hangs out on Twitter because Twitter is so like has such a concentration of like venture capitalists, venture backed startups and other founders. Honestly, there's a feeling of like lack of success that I feel where I see some of these people that I engage. It's almost like it's the double-edged sword to amazing access is like I get incredible access to unbelievable founders and VCs. But on the other side, I'm like, shit, I've only built one business and I'm talking to these people that have built $4 billion companies. Like, what am I doing with my life? And I think that's a really unhealthy thing that I find as well.
Yeah, no, it sounds like I think I'm very suspicious of things that are motivated by FOMO. And yep. So like, you're saying like, well, what would I miss if I wasn't on it? I'm like, okay, that's like a good thing to not do.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I think it's really interesting. And I think almost like another way to frame this is like, how could I find great connection and community without the trade-off of my mental health?
Totally. Well, let me ask you then, other than Morning Brew, what does, because this is another, I think, source of misery and disorientation for people, is what does your media diet look like? As someone who sort of does this professionally, but also probably has peered behind the curtain a little bit, what does your media diet look like?
I would say the vast majority of what I consume is bookmarks that I've bookmarked on Twitter. It is
What does that mean?
So as in like I've, you know, my cure, like I have the people that I follow on Twitter.
When Twitter's I see like something, your newspaper.
Yeah, exactly. And when I see interesting stuff that I follow, I'll bookmark it. And now you can have folders in your bookmarks. So I have one folder for entrepreneurship, one folder for mindfulness and spirituality. And I, every day when I dedicate time to consumption, I go to those folders and I go through the content. And you know, typically like tweet threads have become a big thing, right? Like a string of tweets. That'll be a lot of times stuff that I'm bookmarking. So that's one. The second would be just like close connections, friends, contacts that I'm like texting with, just sharing articles and things for me to read. So referrals. And then the final one, honestly, I read a bunch of essays. Like I actually don't like reading this sounds so ironic because it is. I don't read that much news.
Yeah.
Like I read The Brew every day. I read maybe one or two other newsletters, but for the most part, I would say 95% of my media diet is evergray or evergreen, things that were written a while ago or have a longer shelf life. And a site I always go to read essays is it's called readsomethinggreat.com.
Oh, I've never heard of this.
And it's amazing. It's basically, it's a website that has manually curated essays and it offers you 5 at a time. And it's always the same categories. The first category is living better. The second category is business and tech. The third category is history and culture. The fourth is science and nature. And the fifth is wild card. And basically it's essays that have been vetted by the person who created this site. They, you know, they range from being a 2-minute read to a 2-hour read. And I just find amazing content here. And what I love about this is it helps me with discovery of great writers. And then once I find a great writer, I'll go down the writer rabbit hole and I'll just read everything by them. And that actually leads me to another site, which is called alias.co. And honestly, you may even be on alias.co. Let me see.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, no, you're not on it yet. Basically, it's a site that allows you to go down the rabbit hole of people. So you go into alias.co and it has a whole directory of people. So for example, right now I'm looking at Bology. I'm looking at Paul Graham. I'm looking at Reshma Sajani, the founder of Girls Who Code. And it has every podcast, YouTube video, tweet, and essay that they have ever appeared on or written. And so it's like, if you want to study the mind of a person, it is the place to study the mind of people that have been curated.
Interesting. Yeah, this is cool. So wait, so you have to join Alias or they decide who is featured on Alias?
They decide who's featured. So I think as they're spending time on it, like if you go to the search bar, right, you can look up your name and you'll see it says notify me. I think they basically say once a certain person has had notify me clicked a lot of times, it's their signal to curate that person's content. And so I think right now, you know, they probably have 50 people on here. And I think their goal is just to expand it over time. But to me, it's like the combination of read something great reveals really interesting people who think in a new way that gets me to think differently. And then if these people are on Alias, I'll go down the rabbit hole of everything they've created on Alias.
Right. No, this is interesting. I like read something great. This is cool too. I do like sort of people who write long form stuff. That's kind of why I like podcasts too. Like the idea of a sort of medium that's not dependent on virality. It's just dependent on sort of
quality.
Yeah. Or, but also it's just like, it's in depth and the fact that
exactly.
Yeah. It tends to create better stuff.
And by the way, this is like one of my whole thoughts of it's such an interesting thing that like, other than for commoditized content, I rarely use Google anymore. And so like the best content on the internet sits in like the nooks and crannies of the internet, usually through referral or curation. And it's just so interesting that like I have to do all these steps to find the most interesting stuff because it's never going to be the stuff that shows up on Google.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because these two sites you mentioned are like the opposite of Twitter.
Exactly. Maybe I should just spend more time on these sites and less on Twitter.
I think so. I think so. No, that's fascinating. What newsletters do you like?
So, obviously Morning Brew. I like, James Clear's newsletter, mm-hmm. 3-2-1. I like Not Boring. So Packy McCormick's newsletter. He analyzes, basically tech trends and, up and coming startups. I love Ben Thompson. I just think he's like one of the smartest thinkers about technology companies. Honestly, I'm looking for more in my newsletter diet that doesn't have to do with business, that either has to do with, again, like psychology, mindfulness, mental health, et cetera. So if you have any recommendations, I'm interested in those, but those are my top few.
Well, I may recommend the Daily Stoic email, which goes out every morning, and it's one thought about stoicism. What do I like that's not? I like. Do you like Maria Popova? She does brain.
Oh, is that
pickings.
Brain pickings?
Yeah, she just I've changed heard of it. The I name. Read it. I think you'd like that one.
Okay.
I like this one's more business, but Matt Levine's newsletter.
He's great.
He's because even though like it would seem very Wall Street-y, but it's actually.
He's hilarious.
Yes.
He's hilarious. He has a great sense of humor. I've always thought to myself, if he went off like away from Bloomberg and onto like Substack's platform, he would be the number one supported writer on Substack.
Yeah, probably because he could charge like $500 a year for it.
Exactly.
Because, yes.
Exactly.
No, his is great. I like Emily Oster. I mean, this is more of a parenting thing, but Emily Oster's is fantastic. It's
I've never
a parenting
heard of
one.
Her. Let me see.
Who else do I like?
Yeah, I'm not a parent yet, so I may have to bookmark this for when I end up becoming a parent.
I do a parenting email each day, each morning too, called Daily Dad.
Oh, nice.
Those are the two that I write. But yeah, I do. I think that's a good point. I wish there was more non-political, non-business sort of daily, or weekly or whatever, just sort of thoughts about, life or, psychology or trends or business or whatever.
I've been thinking there could be a cool, I have a few newsletter ideas that, I haven't started, but I think would be amazing. One being like just a positive email, like literally just like three things that make you smile to start your day, like a quote, a picture, a video, that just get your day going with momentum and realize how, and allow you to practice gratitude through example.
I think that's right. I like Tim's Five Bullet Friday. I think that's
yep.
That's I get a lot out of that one. And then actually, one of my he started as my research assistant, and now he does content for Daily Stoic. But he has one called Six at Six, where it's like six things every Sunday. I like that one a lot.
But where do I find that?
Let me see how. I don't remember. Just let me get the name.
Okay.
Here.
You can let me know later if you want.
It's billyoppenheimer.com. It's called Six at Six.
Okay.
For everyone who wants to sign up. But no, I think, I guess what we're hopefully kicking around as we wrap up is that there's a business opportunity and a market opportunity here for people who can create content that does not make people angry at the world when they're
exactly.
done reading it. But it generally improves their life. Or
yeah, I was gonna say,
something to think about.
Content that invests in yourself, and it doesn't have to be investing in yourself at work. Like,
yes,
I just because I was feeling that need. Also, I just started a book club with founders. But the whole my whole thing was, you're signing up for this if you don't want to read business books. Where like we can. We can have discussion, or we're going to have a book club, but it's not going to be business books. It's going to be about everything from like fantasy to historical fiction to poetry.
That's right. No, that's true. I like that. I like that also. I think books shouldn't just be, about current events.
Totally.
Well, this is awesome, man. I'm so glad we got connected, and this was a good way to get to know each other, I think.
Yeah, man, I love it. I've never done an intro conversation in the form of a podcast, but I love it.
Well, I figured, I don't know about you, but I've never had a, like, let's get to know each other phone call that either wasn't a complete waste of time or wasn't so good that it should have just been recorded. Do you know what I mean?
No, so, no, I think it's really smart.
I figured we'd try it, and I think it went well. Well, this was awesome, and I'm going to check out all these sites, and we'll be in touch,
and let me know if I can be helpful in any way.
You got it. Let me know when you're in Texas.
I will. Talk to you soon.
You know, the Stoics in real life met at what was called the Stoa, the Stoa Pokile, the Painted Porch in ancient Athens. Obviously, we can't all get together in one place. First off, because this community is like hundreds of thousands of people and we couldn't fit in one space. But we have made a special digital version of the Stoa. We're calling it Daily Stoic Life. It's an awesome community. You can talk about, like, today's episode. You can talk about the emails, ask questions. That's one of my favorite parts, is interacting with all these people who are using Stoicism to be better in their actual real lives. You get more Daily Stoic meditations over the weekend, just for the Daily Stoic Life members, quarterly Q&As with me, cloth-bound edition of our Best of Meditations, plus a whole bunch of other stuff, including discounts. And this is the best part, all our Daily Stoic courses and challenges totally for free, hundreds of dollars of value every single year, including our New Year, New You Challenge. We'd love to have you join us. There's a two-week trial totally for free. Check it out at dailystoiclife.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.